Human civilization is at an inflection point. Inflationary monetary policy against the backdrop of technological deflation means either that ever more power will become concentrated in the hands of the state, or that one by one, individuals will voluntarily opt into and adopt a superior monetary system, the rules of which cannot be arbitrarily changed. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, my fellow FOMO sexuals? We have got a new and surprisingly boring all-time high in Bitcoin right now. Coinbase has just gone public, which is, you know, really cool in a certain context and kind of like who cares in another. Maybe I'll talk about that a bit in the next Guy's Take episode or something. If you guys want my opinion on it, let me know. But it is a lovely day for reading about Bitcoin. And we have an awesome piece from first-time author on the pod, actually, Dylan LeClaire. And this one's published on Bitcoin Magazine. You should definitely be following Dylan on the tweets, by the way. He is BTCization, so Bitcoinization, except for BTC, for his handle. Link in the show notes, OBS. And his piece is all about the long-term debt cycles, the incredible imbalance and tower of cards that is currently shaking, and what it all means for Bitcoin. Before we get into it, though, make sure you are stacking sats automatically on a regular basis, or you will miss these dips and these great sideways opportunities that we just had for the last month or so. Do it automatically with a Swan Bitcoin savings plan. Every week, month, or even daily, you set it and forget it. SwanBitcoin.com/guy will get you some free sats to start off your plan, and they even have free withdrawals. So they want you to hold your own keys, which makes having a secure cold storage device like the BitBox O2 even more cost efficient for the incredible security and peace of mind you get with it. Hold your own keys with the BitBox O2. Check out the BitBox O2 hardware wallet at guyswan.com, and that's Swan with two N's, /BitBox. It is a perfect solution specifically for those who want the security but are kind of intimidated by hardware wallets. They make it really a simple process and user experience. I highly recommend it. With that, let's get into today's article, and it's titled "The Conclusion of the Long-Term Debt Cycle and the Rise of Bitcoin" by Dylan LeClaire. The conclusion of the long-term debt cycle is an inescapable economic reality that coincides with the ascent of the Bitcoin network. In this article, I will detail why the incumbent global financial system is irreversibly broken, how it got to this point, and what the world will look like coming out the other side of the present crisis. I will use the frameworks presented in Ray Dalio's Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises, along with my own analysis to contextualize the global economic landscape. And I will detail how the emergence of Bitcoin as a global monetary asset will serve as a release valve. For an abridged version of Principles for Navigating Big Debt Crises, watch this excellent 30-minute video produced by Dalio himself. Link will be available in the show notes. The cyclicity of debt. To put it simple, debt is cyclical. When you borrow money today, you increase your buying power today at the expense of the buying power of your future self. Buying something you cannot afford today means that you are spending more than you make. You are borrowing not only from the lender, but also from your future productivity and output. In an economic system built on credit, expansions and contractions of credit availability serve as drivers of economic growth activity and contraction recessions, respectively. This holds true at both the individual and macroeconomic levels. When an individual borrows money to consume or invest and does not receive a positive return, it decreases that person's future investment, consumption, or spending. The same framework applies to sectors of an economic system, or more broadly, economic systems as a whole. Although productivity is the most important aspect of an economic system over the long term, not productivity but the forces of debt and credit are the main driving forces in volatile economic swings. Time value of money. The time value of money is a very important concept in the roles of debt and credit in an economic system. Explained simply, any rational economic actor would prefer to receive money today rather than the same amount of money in the future. There is an opportunity cost to parting with money, and the return that one could earn on their money tomorrow by parting with it today should theoretically be positive to compensate for risk and opportunity cost. The interplay between the short and long-term debt cycles. Although most are familiar with the short-term debt cycle, many are unfamiliar with the concept of the long-term debt cycle, which is of much greater significance. The reason why many are unfamiliar with the long-term debt cycle is because it repeats very rarely, once about every 75 to 100 years. Most people live their entire lives without experiencing the conclusion of a long-term debt cycle, and thus its significance is rarely understood. Below, I will outline the archetypal short and long-term debt cycles and present some historical context and current statistics to frame the current state of the domestic and global economy. The short-term debt cycle, 7 to 10 years. Debt cycles can be observed by viewing debt-to-income ratios and interest rates, among other metrics. Although there has not been a completely free market for the cost of capital during the era of central banking, interest rates set by central banks serve as the risk-free rate upon which the economic foundation is built. With the advantage of hindsight, one can clearly see many examples of short-term debt cycles, more commonly known as the boom and bust cycle, by looking at the interest rates set by central banks. The long-term debt cycle, 75 to 100 years. The long-term debt cycle is made up of numerous short-term debt cycles. Debt crises occur because debt and debt servicing costs rise more rapidly than incomes are able to support them, which necessitates deleveraging. In response to credit contraction, central banks can lower interest rates, which reduces relative debt servicing costs and provides the economy with a stimulative boost. This process repeats itself as productive investments are made, and then the self-reinforcing upward boom of credit expansion brings about speculative activity and misallocation of capital. Eventually, the debt burden and interest expenses grow far too large to service, and central banks respond by again cutting interest rates. Over the course of each cycle, interest rates at the cyclical peak and trough are lower than those at the peak and trough of the previous cycle. This process repeats until the interest rate reductions that enabled each subsequent expansion can no longer continue, as interest rates reach the lower bound of zero. Interest rates hitting zero marks the beginning of the end for a currency regime, as it signifies that debt loads across the economic system have reached unsustainable levels. The logical path from that point, if we follow policymakers' incentive structure with a historical perspective, is to sacrifice the value of the currency. Types of monetary policy. In a deleveraging event, three main forms of monetary policy can be used to ease the debt burden, as defined by Dalio in Big Debt Crises. Monetary Policy 1, interest rate-driven monetary policy. This is the go-to tool used by central banks and is the most effective tool to, quote, stimulate the economy. This is because lowering rates, one, raises the present value of assets, two, makes it easier to buy items and invest with credit, and three, reduces the debt servicing burden. Interest rate reduction is almost always the first response to a debt crisis, if there is room to cut the rates any further. Monetary policy 2, quantitative easing, or QE, or printing money to buy debt securities and financial assets. QE places cash in the hands of investors, who then seek to redeploy it into other financial instruments. Some economists argue that QE is not money printing because the process involves swapping out a financial asset for an equal amount of cash. This logic is flawed, as the freshly printed cash places bids in the credit markets that would not have otherwise existed. QE positively affects investors and asset values, but does very little to help those without assets. In many cases, including the present-day situation, this widens the wealth gap significantly. The more that QE is used, the less effective it becomes. QE is the most effective when there is a lack of liquidity in financial markets, but once credit markets have sufficiently reinflated, the effects diminish with each marginal unit of currency that is printed. Monetary Policy 3. Stimulus payments. This form of policy puts money directly in the hands of the people. The recent popularization and support for universal basic income and stimulus checks are examples of monetary policy number 3. This form of monetary policy is used because the first two forms disproportionately benefit the investor class, leaving the middle and lower classes struggling to get by. Political acceptance of this type of monetary policy becomes most prevalent late in a debt cycle, when wealth gaps are the most severe and the masses are looking for any possible way to get ahead. Another form of this type of monetary policy is debt-financed fiscal spending monetized by the central bank, or what is today being called modern monetary theory. A brief overview of monetary history. The dollar and the global monetary order changed considerably in 1971 with the Nixon shock. With other nations having previously agreed to peg their currencies to the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar redeemable for gold by global central banks, the decision by Nixon to, quote, temporarily close the gold window in August 1971 changed the global monetary order forever. Shortly following this decision, in March 1973, the currencies of the G10 nations abandoned the fixed exchange rate standard and began to float in the open market. For the first time in history, nearly the entire world, with an increasingly developed and interconnected global economy, had free-floating, i.e. purely fiat, currencies. As a result, a very interesting dynamic has become increasingly prevalent, whereby nations are incentivized to competitively devalue their currencies, and thus the cost of capital within their domestic economies, to attract foreign capital inflows and boost their export markets. If a nation maintains the strength of its currency and does not devalue it along with the rest of the world's fiat currencies, the country's buying power appreciates significantly, but its domestic manufacturing base and competitiveness in international trade diminish significantly. Although the dollar and monetary policy decisions of the Federal Reserve are domestic, the decisions made by policymakers do not exist in a vacuum and are influenced by the dollar's role as the international economy's global reserve currency. The end game. It is clear that we are in the final stages of a debt supercycle that has played out over the last 80 years. We are in the end game of the current monetary order, and something new will have to fill the void. A side note here. I highly encourage you go to this article because there have already been a couple of charts. but I just didn't want to take the time to really kind of read these things out. But it's really kind of amazing when you look at the really long-term pictures of these things, how clear some of these cycles actually are. And this chart here that we have, the effective federal funds rate, shows a constant up and down on a shorter time frame while showing a very large overall curve, where from the 1950s to the 1980s, we were slowly increasing the federal funds rate, and then we peaked and started coming back down. And since 1980 to 2010, it was decreasing, and now it's been effectively at zero, save for a short attempt in the late 2010s to try to raise it back up to somewhat normal levels before obviously collapsing back to zero in 2020. So in short, there is a lot of data and numerous charts in this piece to help visualize what's going on, and I highly encourage you to go check it out. I'll have the link in the show notes. Let's jump back in. Over the last four decades, interest rates have been in a secular downtrend, and conversely, debt loads have continued to pile up across the economic system. Every economic boom that has occurred since 1981 has been aided by stimulus in the form of looser monetary policy. This can be observed in a chart of the effective federal funds rate, as well as the year-over-year percentage change in real GDP. Long-term growth in productivity and technology resulted from human entrepreneurship and ingenuity, but over the short to medium term, credit cycles have important impacts on economic activity. Note the reduction of interest rates that follows every decline in real GDP. Interest rates peaked at 19% in 1981, and over the last 40 years, they have been in a secular downtrend. In other words, for the last 40 years, the discounted cash flows have caused every asset to skyrocket. Bonds, equities, and real estate have all appreciated by orders of magnitude based on the valuations supported by ever-decreasing interest rates, and these price increases cannot be effectively measured with the flawed CPI metric. Now, with the Federal Reserve's funding rates at the zero lower bound, reducing interest rates is no longer an option. Below are charts that illustrate three of the latest short-term debt cycles, as observed by the effective federal funds rate. And here he has three separate charts showing the steady growth and then sharp declines in interest rate over the last three short-term debt cycles. The major declines landing in 2020, 2008 and 2009, and then 2001. Second-order effects of easy monetary policy. A side effect of the increasingly easy monetary policy over the past decades has been significant asset price inflation. The majority of the increase in asset prices has not been the result of increased productivity or output, but rather the result of massive credit expansion and lessening discount rates following each subsequent bust or deleveraging event. Asset price inflation concentrates wealth into the hands of the few, and social unrest and popular polarization are second-order effects of this. Quote, wealth gaps increase during bubbles, and they become particularly galling for the less privileged during hard times. It is during such times that populism on both the left and the right tends to emerge. How well the people and the political system handle this is key to how well the economy and the society weather the period. As shown below, both inequality and populism are on the rise in the U.S. today, much as they were in the 1930s. In both cases, the net worth of the top 0.1% of the population equaled approximately that of the bottom 90% combined. End quote. From Big Debt Crises. Again, there is a really great chart here showing the comparative wealth distribution of the bottom 90% and top 0.1%. Link will be in the show notes. With this framing, the polarization and political division that have emerged in the United States over the last decade makes sense. There is nothing new under the sun. And if we turn back time, we can view similar instances throughout history. The increasingly popular populist movements and policies that have taken hold in the United States are an expected response from a class of people who have been hurt by monetary policy decisions that have spanned across decades. Anyone focusing on the individual actors and not the systematic inequality created and enabled by easy monetary policy is missing what has truly taken place. Quote, in some cases, raising taxes on the rich becomes politically attractive because the rich made a lot of money in the boom, especially those working in the financial sector, and are perceived to have caused the problems because of their greed. The central bank's purchases of financial assets also disproportionately benefit the rich, because the rich own many more such assets. Big political shifts to the left typically hasten redistributive efforts. This typically drives the rich to try to move their money in ways and to places that provide protection, which itself has effects on asset and currency markets. From big debt crises. A recent example can be seen in the push by Democratic senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders to pass a wealth tax. Different from a standard capital gains tax, a wealth tax would confiscate a percentage of one's wealth above a certain net worth threshold. Many people across the political spectrum believe that these policies are needed because of the, quote, ills of capitalism. However, the irony is that the massive economic imbalance and wealth inequality currently present in the United States and worldwide are not the results of free market capitalism. The large proportion of wealth held by the 1% and the investor class is not the result of productivity gains, but rather financial engineering enabled by easy monetary policy. Free market capitalism? Not so fast. Although the United States is frequently described as being free market capitalist, this statement is not exactly true. Here is why. In a free market capitalist economic system, the most important pricing mechanism is that of money. When there is a monopolist institution setting the price of money, the market is inherently not free. There is nothing free about reducing the price of money whenever there is an economic downturn, including the most recent injections of hundreds of billions and now trillions of dollars into financial markets whenever a major liquidation of malinvestment occurs. This monopolistic pricing of money has partially enabled past systemic crises and will ensure the growth of future imbalance and excess. This is what has enabled the gross misallocation of capital, the effects of which are most glaringly obvious in the negative real interest rates offered in sovereign debt markets. The time value of money equals negative. With the Federal Reserve pegging interest rates at zero, along with conducting massive QE programs to monetize federal deficits, the underlying risk-free rates of the financial system actually promise return-free risk. As a result, asset valuations have soared, and the holders of said assets have gotten exponentially more wealthy. The wealth divide has been further exacerbated since the 2008 financial crisis. Below is the S&P 500 index, which has risen nearly 500% in just 12 years, fueled by the ZIRP, zero interest rate policy, and QE. A recent study by the Federal Reserve Board's Survey of Consumer Finances found that the top 10% of U.S. households owned 84% of all U.S. equities, whereas the bottom 50% of households held just 1%. This alone establishes that when Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell states that Fed policies, quote, absolutely don't contribute to wealth inequality, he is flat out lying to save face. Full stop. What comes next? So what happens next? The gap between the haves and have-nots has never been wider. Central banks have been promising to keep interest rates at 0% for quite some time, and debt loads across the entire economy are larger and more unsustainable than ever before. There is mathematically no way out of the current economic environment. The only path forward that policymakers know is more of what caused the problems in the first place. More stimulus in the form of QE to provide financial markets with additional liquidity and suppress yields, and fiscal stimulus in the form of direct checks and aid to the people to minimize unrest. This is not a sustainable system, as it is supported by exponentially expanding the monetary base, which simply exacerbates the problems of the current economic environment. In this reality, asset prices will continue to go parabolic, and it will become increasingly hard to get by for the lower and middle classes as real wages decrease due to monetary policy coupled with technological advancement stripping away automatable jobs that were previously performed by humans. The current actions being taken are simply not a long-term solution, as a look at the empirical data shows. Displayed below is a series of charts that show various debt and income metrics since 2000. Feel free to draw your own conclusions from them. Corporate earnings have grown 55% since 2000. Corporate debt has grown 166% since 2000. The median household income has grown 63% since 2000. Total liabilities, households, and nonprofit organizations has grown 146% since 2000. The gross domestic product has grown 115% since 2000. Debt, securities, and loans for all sectors has grown 206% since 2000. And the federal debt has grown 380% since 2000. Technology changing the rules. The problem with chasing perpetual growth fueled by ever-increasing credit expansion is that the rules of the game have changed. Technology has fundamentally changed the rules of our economic system, and our monetary policy is unable to adjust. We live in a world where rapidly improving and advancing technology continues to give us more for less. As jobs of the past are automated away, and technology continues to drive the costs of many aspects of life to near zero, our monetary system necessitates that everything to continue to increase in cost in nominal terms in perpetuity. Even though technological advances should be giving everyone the gift of a higher standard of living for less real cost, the incumbent monetary system must avoid deflation at all costs. In a world that is experiencing exponential technological growth, exponentially more stimulus and debt are needed to keep the system glued together. Without ever-increasing amounts of stimulus in the form of central bank balance sheet expansion, the debt loads that have built up over the last 40 years would unwind. The cost of debt would explode in real terms. All of the banks would become insolvent, and the global economic system would experience a massive depression. Remember, it is only possible to consume more than you produce for so long at both the microeconomic and macroeconomic levels. Shown below are the balance sheets of the world's major central banks. Although this piece has focused on the U.S. domestic economy, this figure shows that we have been describing a global phenomenon. Policymakers are trapped by decisions made decades before their tenures. Their actions make sense with this framing, but that does not make said actions right or a practical long-term solution for the global monetary and economic system. Human civilization is at an inflection point. Inflationary monetary policy, against the backdrop of technological deflation, means either that ever more power will become concentrated in the hands of the state, or that one by one, individuals will voluntarily opt out and adopt a superior monetary system, the rules of which cannot be arbitrarily changed. The solution, Bitcoin. Quote, at this stage in the long-term debt cycle, policymakers sometimes monetize debt in even larger quantities in an attempt to compensate for its declining effectiveness. While this can help for a bit, there is a real risk that prolonged monetization will lead people to question the currency's suitability as a storehold of value. This can lead them to start moving to alternative currencies, such as gold. The fundamental economic challenge most economies have in this phase is that the claims on purchasing power are greater than the abilities to meet them. From Big Debt Crises. We are seeing this play out today. The global economic system is so over-indebted that there would be a deflationary collapse without ever-increasing liquidity injections and stimulus. As a result of rates being stuck at the zero lower bound and exponentially increasing debt monetization, a mass default is occurring not explicitly, but implicitly. The error term is the value of the currency itself, which in this case is the dollar. A debt jubilee is coming in the form of creditors having their purchasing power wiped out. During a period of debt monetization, the rational economic incentive is to protect one's wealth by seeking out assets that cannot be devalued or printed, like Bitcoin. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. With its perfectly inelastic programmatic supply issuance, it is the logical choice for every rational economic actor to adopt as a primary store of value, medium of exchange, and eventually unit of account for all economic calculations. Quote, quite often they are motivated to move their money out of the country, which contributes to currency weakness, dodge taxes, and seek safety in liquid, non-credit dependent investments, example, low-risk government bonds, gold, or cash. This typically drives the rich to try to move their money in ways and to places that provide protection, which itself has effects on asset and currency markets. From Big Debt Crises. As previously mentioned, wealth taxes and increasingly ambitious taxation methods are being floated around the political sphere as, quote, solutions to the record wealth gap. History and economic reality tell a different story. These taxes are rarely effective, as the wealthy find a way to move their wealth outside of the taxable domain. Now, with the emergence of Bitcoin, there is a seizure and censorship-resistant asset that is outside the domain of any one jurisdiction. With Bitcoin, it is possible to store wealth in a self-sovereign way, with absolutely zero counterparty or credit risk. Any individual or entity facing unfavorable tax codes can simply protect their wealth behind a wall of encrypted energy, free from the state's needy hands. The incumbent monetary order is irreversibly broken. In a process that has unfolded over nearly a century, the monetary system of the United States and the world has changed, and a small class of people have benefited at everyone else's expense. If you are pro-humanity, then you must agree that a system of rules is superior to a system of rulers. Against the backdrop of technological advancement, a compatible monetary system is needed. Money is the coordination function of every action in the economy. And Bitcoin is the best tool humanity has ever had at its disposal to harness this function. With Bitcoin, money is once again a free market phenomenon, and humanity will flourish as a result. For 12 years, Bitcoin has entrenched itself worldwide as an alternative monetary system that individuals are free to voluntarily adopt. Despite never-ending streams of denouncements from economic experts and monetary authorities, Bitcoin continues to exponentially increase in value. Now, with the incumbent monetary order cannibalizing itself, here stands Bitcoin, a digital monetary network that provides direct incentives for every individual and entity on the planet to adopt it. A great debt jubilee is coming, and it will later be known as hyper-Bitcoinization. All right. That was by Dylan LeClaire. Let's go ahead and get our sponsor real fast, and then I definitely want to get a guy's take in on this piece. Do you know how to protect yourself from the consequences of the long-term debt cycle, aside from just owning Bitcoin? Don't hold a debt instrument. Don't hold dollars. They're just another form of credit. And don't hold IOUs from an exchange. Hold your own keys on your personal Bitcoin cold storage device, the Bitbox O2. And if getting a hardware wallet for your Bitcoin sounds intimidating, then honestly, this is the one you want. It's secure, it's open source, and it is one of the simplest user experiences I have had with a hardware wallet to date. And coming from the guy who has literally used all of them, that's saying something. The setup takes just a few minutes. The software is intuitive and really straightforward. The device itself is clean and minimalist. And they even have a number of other great security and kind of backup tools available on the Shift Crypto store, like the Steel wallet. They've got tamper-evident bags, lots of other great stuff. You can check all of them out and get your Bitbox O2 with a 5% discount at guyswan.com/bitbox. Great piece from Dylan here. And one of the things that's so true that he hits like right at the beginning is how misunderstood, or I guess you could say invisible, the long-term debt cycles really are, because they last the length of a generation, like a lifespan. You know, they are the life expectancy. So most people never think on that long of a time scale. You know, these long-term debt cycles are 75 to 100 years, and we're right now roughly 80 years into one. And it is the very thing. That debt cycle has really been the major push for shifting monetary standards throughout history. It coincides, that shifting monetary base coincides with those long-term debt collapses. And you could make the argument, and I really do make the argument pretty often, that the long-term debt cycle is not natural. In fact, the short-term ones in the kind of 70-year time frames are unnatural as well. That I think in a natural, in an actual free market, the debt cycles would be much shorter. They'd be much quicker and cleaner, and it would keep the economy healthy. But that it's fundamentally the abuse and key vulnerabilities in how our monetary systems work that actually enable these long-term, these extensive, sustained debt imbalances. I mean, he talks about it in this piece, is that, you know, it's the response to this that the central bank takes. It's the controlling and lowering of the interest rates. It's the printing of money. It's the stimulus. It's the QE. It's all of these things that specifically create and sustain and worsen the imbalance that we've been doing over the last 40 years since we've peaked in this previous long-term debt cycle. If you immunize against that, if you plug that vulnerability, which has always been present for, you know, 500-600 years at least in our global financial system. Even if you go back to Roman times and you think about it in the context of coin clipping and changing the actual monetary makeup, the purity of the metals in the coins back to the era of kings and empires and these sorts of things, which, you know, the American and British Empire notwithstanding, going way back, you know, thousands of years, the same held true. The same truths ended up playing out. But if you look at the time frames, it was actually far, far longer in those days because it was done over centuries. And at the base, the money itself was still sound. The money itself was still traded in a physical sense. We've actually accelerated the cause and effect of the manipulation because we have gone to a fully virtual economy since like the 1500s. And I mean virtual in the sense that we trade paper promises, that we've moved to paper money. A really great breakdown of all of that stuff, Layered Money by Nick Bhatia, that I did the audiobook for. If you haven't listened to it, he goes through the entire history of the creation, really, of the first paper money, IOUs and exchange, like the first, like the Amsterdam Bourse and all of these things that created the basis of what we think of as a layered financial system in the modern era. And it's crazy eye-opening to see it through that context and then look at what Bitcoin is fundamentally doing to shift the base, like the utter foundation of the financial system, and putting it into an entirely new context. Back to the kind of fundamental idea here is that I think all of those problems, those vulnerabilities, the idea of coin clipping and those imbalances and the controlling of debt and interest rates, that it's far more potent. The vulnerabilities were worse, even though the benefits are also greater. So the benefits of a virtual economy are the sheer speed and communicability of our value and trade, of our exchange. You know, without a virtual economy, there's no way you could do business with China. If there was no way to, there was no central authority to dictate and quote unquote enforce the shifting of capital goods and the subsequent enforcement of the promise of that value, which is the money, some paper note that says it's proof of my value, proof of my work in the past. If there's nobody to enforce that, if there's no system to secure that promise, even one that's got a massive, awful vulnerability that gets abused and corrupted in the political sphere, regardless, that the benefit from using that is still a technological improvement because the economy moves at a billion times the pace as it did going 1,000 years in the past. But in the same sense, the vulnerabilities are larger. The problems of authority become even more embedded in the system. And then you get these things like these quote-unquote long-term debt cycles, which really in the grand scheme of things are short-term constant refreshes of the financial and monetary base because they have an inescapable flaw: control. They have rulers. And actually, this is great. Love the quote here that Dylan hits somewhere in this piece. I can't even remember, but it was something along the lines of that obviously a system of rules is superior to a system of rulers. And that's the difference between the fiat system and the money that we are currently operating under, which has this massive capability of abuse and corruption, and a system like Bitcoin that simply is a codified, incorruptible, easily provable set of rules that you can merely adopt. But these huge debt imbalances are really about price manipulation. They're about the lack. Even though all things in an economy are cyclical, we should be able to basically every year wipe out everybody who is overleveraged. And if we had a sound monetary good, if we had the ability to always pull our value out or prove reserves, if we were over-collateralized like in the Bitcoin economy, like I don't think Bitcoin will ever experience the same degree. I don't think it can experience the same degree of imbalance. There are too many market pressures that are always correcting it, and it is too easy to exit from whatever manipulation or corruption of price that is actually happening. The problem is our inability to exit from it in the legacy system. So it is the lack of real prices for the time value of money, which is exactly what Bitcoin fixes. So first we need to understand why there is a time value of money in the first place. And usually I just kind of assume, but I just want to hit this point a little bit because I recently had a conversation, actually a couple of conversations, with people who legitimately said that interest rates, like an interest on something, on capital, is actually like evil and unnatural. And I just don't see it that way. all capital has a cost, period. I mean, just like Dylan says in the article, is that the interest rate is the most important price because it is the price of time. You have an opportunity cost. You have a huge opportunity cost for waiting to use your capital in a year, and even more so, letting someone else potentially use it in your stead during that time span rather than using it now. You have no idea what's going to happen in that year. You could die. The person that you're lending it to could die. Your entire situation could change. You might find out you need it tomorrow, even though you signed this 1 year agreement to not use it at all. Nobody has the slightest clue what's going to happen. Therefore, any time that you have left yourself unable to consume the resources and value you have already produced is a massive cost and a risk. It is an uncertainty. People pay to resolve or remove uncertainties in the market. It's a crazy important product, is security, is insurance, is stability. And that's all the economy is, right? It's a giant buffer from us in the chaos of reality. But just go back to the fundamental idea that capital has a cost. If I use your car for a week, and so you can't use it, I rent it from you, right? You're not going to let me do that for free if you need it. You're going to do that for a cost. Money is the exact same thing, except that it's just not tied to a single asset. It's a redeem for anything capital good rather than explicitly a car that you can only do car things with. You could use that capital, the rented capital, to get a car. And then maybe that rent is actually really low. The rent for your capital, for the money, the interest that you pay on the money, might even be lower than what it would be to rent a car. Like, you know, maybe it costs you $1,000 or $1,500 a month to rent a car and just keep renting it. But if instead you rent the money and buy a car, maybe the interest on the money only costs you $500 a month. So in what possible world, if they can both, if both situations can end up with you having a car that someone else can't have, how is it that supposedly you should be, you should, and it makes sense to rent one, but not the other? Fundamentally, the exact same thing is happening in both circumstances. You are borrowing someone else's resources and paying them for the time that they don't get to use it. Now, Dylan doesn't argue that, like, this isn't even in the article, but I just, like I said, I had a conversation recently about that, and I was just kind of surprised with how prevalent that idea was when I just kind of thought that it seemed like an obvious thing. It seems like an intuitive thing to me, but I just figured I'd address it. But back to the concept of the debt cycles, the argument goes that if we have real prices, there is no great enough economic force to imbalance on such a long time frame on one to build up. And maybe there still would be some, like I said, everything is cyclical. Everything has a rhythm. And I have no doubt that there would be expansions and contractions. I mean, shit, just look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin has, if there is anything that Bitcoin has, it is loud, incredibly obvious expansions and contractions. But again, we clean those up really fast. You know, they are on a much, much shorter time scale. And anybody who is irresponsible or over leveraged gets wiped out during the contraction. And the problem with the legacy economy, the problem with corrupt political money, is that they bail out the people who should get eliminated. And the very behaviors that caused the imbalance, that caused the misallocation of resources, get reinforced and rewarded during the collapse, which is exactly what sets it up to never actually correct, and why it goes on for 40 years. And we get socially tied. We turn in this giant socialized loss where everyone is connected to every other person's failure and liabilities and exposed to someone else's bad decisions or irresponsibility. And it goes on for 40 years until the whole thing collapses and the entire society has to pay, even the people who were responsible and tried to save. or made the correct balancing decisions, but could do nothing in the face of having no exit from the exposure to everyone else's mistakes. So I really can't help but think that this would not be a reality in a Bitcoin standard, that there would be no way to sustain such an imbalance for such a long time. But without a doubt, we are at the end of one of those cycles. And I think we are in straight up the end game, in the sense that the current monetary regime, the current monetary standard of free-floating currencies that has existed really since the 70s, is not sustainable. Like, it was broken and destined to die in 1971. Between 71 and 73, basically our doom was set, and it just took us this long to get here. And Dylan talks about, you know, basically the three instruments, like the three responses that can occur from basically the liquidation periods, from the great deleveraging eras of these debt cycles. And the three main instruments are controlling the interest rates, lowering the interest rates to try to prop up with additional debt, with additional false activity, which Dylan does a great job of just like laying out the fundamental idea of what debt is that there's no way for that not to be cyclical. There's no way for that not to require a payment back, because by its very nature, debt is taking resources from your future self. It is using resources today that have to be paid back later. There's no escaping that. And the amount of trying to cover up the most basic truth that we know about debt and credit, what it actually is, it's kind of remarkable. It's remarkable how many fairy tales people will believe in a political context. The government's just going to wave a magic wand and a fundamental reality is just going to vanish. I urge you to listen to Alex Svetsky's Read 515 about the nature of objective truths and subjective realities. He does a great job, really cool way of breaking down that whole philosophical foundation. It's called Utopian Dystopias. In fact, it's yesterday's episode. It was the last episode that was published. If you haven't listened to it, I'll have a link in the show notes. You should definitely check it out. But so the first step is controlling the interest rate. Another tool is quantitative easing, is finding a way to introduce new money into the economy. And then the last is direct stimulus. Now, what's funny is that when he mentions QE, there's actually a little quote that I grabbed because I was just like, oh God, it's so, again, like in the political context, how many people can make themselves believe something that's absolutely just fundamentally absurd? And he brings one of these up and I had to stop. I was just like, oh God, because it just pains me so much when something so obvious is outright denied. But he says, QE, quote, QE places cash in the hands of investors who then seek to redeploy it into other financial instruments. Some economists argue that QE is not money printing because the process involves swapping out a financial asset for an equal amount of cash. This logic is flawed, as the freshly printed cash places bids in the credit markets that would not have otherwise existed, end quote. It is amazing to me that people make that argument. It seems as ridiculous as the Bitcoin isn't finite, Bitcoin isn't scarce because you can infinitely divide it. This is just utter nonsense to suggest that because they swapped it out for a financial asset with an equal amount of cash, that somehow that means it's like backed by the asset. You realize money already, the whole point of money is that it corresponds to assets in the economy. That is how prices are obtained. What is happening in a default crisis, in a deleveraging event, a liquidity crisis, is it a lack of availability of money has revealed that those asset prices are massively overpriced. Thus, they should fall. The prices should correct until people are willing to relinquish money to purchase them again. And instead of that happening, new money is created to buy up the asset at the false price. The idea that this isn't money printing because it's in exchange for an asset is just mind-numbingly ignorant. That is literally all that you do with money. Exchange it for real-world resources and assets. This is like saying that if you counterfeit money, as long as you just go out and buy stuff with it, it's no longer counterfeiting because you exchanged it for assets. What the hell else do you do when you counterfeit money? What are you going to do with it? You don't counterfeit it for the sake of just having a bunch of money. You exchange it for resources. You use it to buy shit. So it's just unbelievable to me that people would make that argument. Like, did you even think for 30 seconds about what that means? Like, extend that out just a little bit further and think about what you just said.
I don't know. It just seems crazy. But that one just really got me. I had to stop reading.
Gather myself up and get back into it. And then the third method is direct stimulus. And we are in the midst of all three. We are, and I think that's kind of a good example of how we kind of know we're in the end game here, is that all three are not only working simultaneously, like being used to their max capacity, basically, at the exact same time, is that everything will collapse if they cut it off. Not only are they having to use every potential tool that they have, the only mechanisms they have to continue to inflate this mess, they can't cut it off anymore. I don't think that there is a way that they can start reeling this back in now. This is why I think it's going to go to UBI. It's going to go to some ridiculous taxes on the wealthy. It's why populism has been on a massive rise. And on that point, actually, I made just a short comment about it during the read, but the U.S. net wealth shares, the comparison of the bottom 90% with the top 0.1%, it's really kind of amazing how sharp or how obvious the turns in that graph are, that it crossed over during the mid-1930s. And in fact, it crossed over both ways. First, the 0.1% went up during the 20s, during the roaring 20s, during that huge debt boom, and then collapsed back down. The 0.1% went back down towards the end of the 1930s, and the bottom 90%, the distribution of wealth was becoming more and more evenly distributed throughout the economy when actually interest rates were on the rise, when you actually had real market prices in some form or fashion. And there was a much better management of a sound monetary policy. And we were on a gold standard to some degree. We still had cycles, and there was still kind of a growing imbalance that I think was kind of inevitable with the, like I said, the ultimate vulnerabilities in our monetary system. But the 0.1% was actually in decline from the 40s into the 70s, and the bottom 90% was in growth. That was the age of the middle class, right? When the middle class was really born into this, into the modern age, and they became the most important demographic. And all of that turned in the 70s. The 90% was a little bit lagging. It moved into the 80s when the interest rates really spiked, and then everything started to turn back around. Everything started to decline. Wealth began to concentrate into asset owners and the stock markets and the financial markets and those who are closer to the monetary spigot. Interest rates got manipulated. The 0.1% continued to get wealthier and wealthier. The bottom 90% got poorer and poorer. And now we have reached an apex and we are crossing back like in the 20s, where the wealthy are soaking up a vast amount of the resources, and they are doing so without actually producing back into society. That's why we are getting net poorer as things go on, there's so many more people who are getting poor than rich people getting rich, is because it's through a manipulation. It's through a political apparatus that can only take from A and give to B and pay themselves a ridiculous salary in the meantime. We've turned into an economy of money shifters, and we've completely exported our production capacity. And, you know, this is actually, he points out, and this is something we've talked about in, I guess, Parker Lewis's piece, The Great Definancialization. We've talked about it in Lynn Alden's piece, The Petrodollar, about the petrodollar system. I think it's like the collapse or something of the petrodollar system. I'll have the link in the show notes. I can't remember the title exactly, but about the era of free-floating currencies and what it does, the incredible consequences and frictions that it puts on the global economy by not having a monetary standard to work off of. There's a quote here that I grabbed on this topic from Dylan's article. It says, "As a result, a very interesting dynamic has become increasingly prevalent, whereby nations are incentivized to competitively devalue their currencies, and thus the cost of capital within their domestic economies, to attract foreign capital inflows and boost their export markets." It is very, very hard to state how much of a burden on global cooperation and economic coordination the accurate balancing of goods and capital around the world it is to have a whole bunch of free-floating fiat currencies that have to be traded against each other. Understand, there are multiple trillions of dollars in volume in the forex markets trying to balance out the prices of currencies and to do business across disparate economies. These are fake barriers. These are artificial barriers. It's like if you create 30,000 arbitrary, stupidly specific laws, suddenly the legal industry, suddenly having lawyers and legal admin assistants and all of these things and contracting, all of this shit, suddenly that industry becomes 800 times the size that it was before you had those 30,000 or whatever arbitrary, like stupidly specific and nonsensical laws. You create an industry that is simply there to try to get over, to remove that huge false burden that has nothing to do with the natural economy. It is a burden, a friction that is forced onto the market through a set of declarations, through government declarations that your debt, your taxes, your whatever are going to be paid in our currency so that we have the ability to print and monetize our own debt, and that we can basically confiscate resources. We can consume resources from our domestic economy at whatever degree we want. We basically have what appears to be a political magic wand, where if we want to pay for something and we don't have the money, somehow we can still pay for it. We can just write ourselves new debt because we are the ones who issue our currency. And that these separate monetary policies have again put us in a situation where we are exposed to other people's failures, irresponsibility, and corruption. Their monetary policies end up affecting our ability, like one country's ability to gain a share of export, because people are exporting paper promises. Rather than competing on productivity and actual growth, countries are competing on the weakness, on the failure of their monetary policies in comparison to their neighbor. In the absence of these artificial barriers, this market would not even exist. It is a multi-trillion dollar drag on the entire global economic organism, and it corrupts prices in every single market. And rather than properly allocating resources based on productivity, real productivity, real supply, and real demand and consumption needs, it's allocated based on monetary policy, based on which political system can devalue their money better and hit that sweet spot of not enough inflation, but just enough inflation to beat the next guy. And then having, and this is why I think the dollar has actually destroyed America, because there's so much demand, there's so much artificial demand for our currency because we have the petrodollar system. Again, linking to or referencing Lynn Alden's a piece on the petrodollar, is we have absolutely gutted our industrial economy. We have gutted our manufacturing and production. We have outsourced everything, and our main export is paper. It is cotton slips of monetary promises that we can't even fulfill. And it is strictly because we have so much artificial demand from people around the world paying, being forced to pay for their energy cost, their oil, in dollars. The amount of value and resources this sucks out of poor nations is really hard to calculate. The idea that America is just supposed to sit over here and consume, as if the poor people in China don't want the washing machines that they are producing or the smartphones, and that they need some country that's going to soak up and use up all of their stuff and give them paper in return, is absurd. This was always a temporary situation. This was never going to last. And like Dylan said, there is a debt jubilee coming. There's no escaping it. We can't afford the situation we're in. We couldn't afford it 20 years ago. And all that's happened is it's gotten way, way, way worse. And he brings up a kind of the fundamental idea of Jeff Booth's book, The Price of Tomorrow, which is great, really great book. Highly recommend it. And there is an audiobook for it. I did the audiobook as opposed to actually read the physical. But the idea that is that the problem is worse than it's ever been because it is in the face of some of the greatest deflationary pressures we've ever experienced. The speed of technological innovation and increasing in efficiency and stuff that we have seen should be one of the greatest value and productivity boosts that our economy has ever experienced. And because of that, that exponential deflationary pressure that is only going to get worse has to be met with more excessive QE, stimulus, money printing, everything that they can do to continually to try to push their value, the value of the currency, down. Because their debts will be absolutely impossible to deal with if they can't do that. If their debts become more expensive with time, the entire bet is that they will become less expensive, is the ability to control interest rates, is to build the ability to service last year's debt with this year's debt. And that's why this gets exponentially worse until the gig is just up. And it's going to be a mess, but it's also going to tap into so many possibilities, an unbelievable potential that has been beaten down, that has been unable to take root because of the constant misallocation, because of the propping up of the zombie companies that are just consuming resources like crazy, and all of these institutions. It's like these dead, rotting trees are preventing the sunlight from hitting the floor of the forest. And there is a literal ocean of new opportunity and new innovation just waiting for a beam of sunlight. And yet these giants are sucking all of the resources, all of the nutrients out of the ground, and they are blocking the sun, and the trees are unhealthy. They are literally dying. And Bitcoin is a tool to open up the canopy, to remove that block, to remove our exposure to each other's failures. You know, one person's debt is an attachment to someone else's failure. It's a counterparty risk asset. You now are liable for someone else. And if you have an economy where I loan to someone else and then I'm liable for their irresponsibility, they loan to the next person, that person loans to the next person, and you have just an entire system where everybody is indebted to everybody else, which is exactly what we have. You have a system where when somebody goes down, everybody else falls like dominoes. Everybody else has no buffer to actually prevent them from collapsing because of the next person collapsing in the line. And that's how you get these stupid, too big to fail sort of scenarios where one bank goes down and it takes the entire financial system with it. Think about how stupid and fragile that system is. Whereas to have assets, to have a positive net value, to have savings, is the very buffer from the next person's irresponsibility. So when you actually hold your own money, when you actually have a bearer asset that is not someone else's authority or permission by which you hold it, it secures you from your neighbor's failures. It secures you from your debtor's irresponsibilities. And it allows that positive feedback loop of productive activity again, and the correct pricing of time and resources in the economy. That is going to unleash an ungodly amount of blocked potential in the global economy. This is why people say we are going to go through a renaissance, because we are going to go through a renaissance. There is going to be 40 years of backed up growth that has been trapped or locked away, or resources have been diverted away and costs have been increased for those exact innovations and things to get done. And they have been directed towards zombie companies that are destroying resources, assets that do not do anything productive and keep going up in price. There is a staggering amount of misallocation of resources, and it is going to flood back into sound money and real prices. And it is going to be something to behold. We'll probably just close this out on this one. I have one last comment, and I love the way Dylan finishes up this article. Real quick, thank you to Swan Bitcoin. Just stacked today. Very happy. And we got a great rallying Bitcoin price. Always fun. SwanBitcoin.com/guy for your Bitcoin savings plan. And of course, put it with your keys. Own your money. Don't be exposed to someone else's irresponsibility. Hold your keys with the BitBox O2 hardware wallet. Open source, secure, and damn it, it's just easy to use. Check them both out at GuySwan.com. But I love how Dylan closes this article out, is that the incumbent monetary order is cannibalizing itself. And it really is. It is sucking up every amount of extra productivity and resources and consuming everything it can. And there has been no exit valve. There has been no way to release the pressure that was actually sustainable, that could actually consume, that could actually account for that amount of value. This is why it's been spread into so many different assets at the same time. There's no one good monetary good. There's not one that's been sufficient enough to take up the helm. Gold has been insufficient for 100 years. Gold failing is the reason we are here. 1971 is proof that gold doesn't work anymore. It's too physical to work in a completely virtualized, digitized economy. And yet here stands Bitcoin. Here stands something that is designed to be a positive security feedback loop for a monetary good that essentially can scale to anything, that has that social scalability for everyone, because you can perfectly verify it. There's no trust involved at all, or at least to the degree in understanding the monetary policy. It is a verifiable, independent set of rules that you adopt by running a node. And it exists everywhere on the planet all at once, and it has not the slightest clue that any of these artificial political and jurisdictional barriers even exist. It cannot and does not care. Quote, "A great debt jubilee is coming, and it will later be known as hyper-Bitcoinization." Amen, Dylan. Right there with you. With that, thank you guys so much for listening. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. Much love to Bitcoin Magazine for always publishing, being such a great resource in this place, in this space, and publishing so much great content. With that, I'm out. Thank you all so much. Until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.